Cow Fox by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 303. His paws were bruised and torn from trying to grasp at passing objects. Completely disoriented, he grabbed at anything. A shattered wooden spar met Dan's grasp, and he seized it, holding tight as he felt himself spilled over the top of another steep downfall. Striking the side, the spar flicked back at him, wiping out his senses with a sharp crack to his head. Darkness and silence enveloped the young squirrel. Dan awakened gradually. Far away he could hear the muted roar of the waterfalls. It was cold, and some beast was anxiously patting his face. "Dan, me old mate, wake up! You can't die and leave me here all on me own! Come on, Dan, I'm begging your mate. Wake up! If you die and leave me down here on me own, I'll never speak to you again, so there!" Opening his eyes, Dan found himself staring into Dippler's tear-stained face. Despite his aching body, the squirrel smiled. "You muddle-headed little ragbag. You'll never speak to me again if I die? That's a good'un, mate." The Gwasom Shrew hugged his friend heartily. "You know what I mean, Dan." Dan clasped Dippler's paw. "Of course I do, matey." Straightening up, they both took stock of their surroundings. The underground river flowed by on their right. They had been washed up on some rocks that skirted a huge pool to the left. Pale green phosphorescent light bathed the immense cavern, and stalactite and stalagmite formations decorated the far reaches of the pool's edge. However, they were of little interest to Dan and Dippler, whose eyes roved the strange place searching for the water bowl. Dippler voiced his thoughts. "I wonder where old Burble's got to." Cupping both paws around his mouth, Dan shouted, "Burble, are you there, mate?" Echoes of the call bounced back from all directions, but there was no reply. Only the distant boom of the falls and a steady plip-plot of water dropping from the high cavern ceiling into the pool. It all sounded very eerie. Dippler gave Dan a worried glance. "Poor old Burb. What if he's..." The young squirrel placed a paw to the shrew's lips. "Don't even mention it, Dip. Come on. Maybe he's been washed farther down river." "Don't fret. We'll find him." Keeping close to the river edge, they pressed onward, sometimes wading waist-deep, other times jumping from rock to rock. Dippler followed Dan. He was in a gloomy mood and took every opportunity to let his companion know it, voicing his thoughts aloud as they went. "Huh, I've gone and lost my blade. What sort of Gwasom must I look like, without a rapier by my side? It's all right for you, mate. You've still got that great sword slung over your back. Poor old me. I've got nothing to defend myself with." Dippler's voice re-echoed about the tunnel they were sloshing through after leaving the cavern. "And I'm so wet and cold that I don't think I'll ever get dry and warm again. Blinkin' head's aching, too." Dan waded forward, trying to ignore Dippler's complaints. "Proper little ray of sunshine, aren't you, Dip? Moanin' ain't going to do us any good. One more word out of you and I'll die and never talk to you again." "Help! You're off me! You dirty great hooligan! Help!" Echoes of Burble's voice boomed all around the tunnel. Dan drew his sword, looking about wildly. "It's Burb. Which way are those sounds coming from?" Dippler pushed past Dan, stumbling and splashing ahead. "Well, he wasn't back where we were, so he must be up that way." The tunnel opened out into another vast cavern. Like the previous one, this also had a rock-bound pool, but far larger than the first. They scrambled up onto the rocks and saw Burble. The water vole was clinging fiercely onto a stalagmite at the shallow side of the pool, flat out in the water. He was caught by the tail, and a veritable monster of a fish was trying to drag him into the deeps. The fish was a barbel, white as snow and completely blind from living in the dark subterranean depths. It was a fearsome sight, with a head as wide as Dan was tall. Dippler hurtled into the shallows and grabbed Burble's paws as they slipped from the smooth, rounded stalagmite. He began a tug-of-war against the barbel, with Burble roaring in a panic, gripping the young Gwasom's paws, trying to lever himself forward, as Dippler dug in, bending over backward, grunting as he tried to heave his friend away from the huge fish. The water vole felt his wet paws slipping from Dippler's grasp as the monstrous barbel pulled, dragging him farther into the fathomless pool with it. "Don't let him get me, Dip! Pull! Pull! Dan, help!" he shrieked. Dan dashed forward and tripped, cannoning into a stalagmite, the limestone column snapping as he struck it. Scrambling upright, the young squirrel hurtled onward, booming echoes of his shouts ringing round the cavern. "Hold on, Burb, I'm coming! Red Wall!" Without thinking, Dan had seized hold of the broken-off stalagmite, unconscious of its weight. Sloshing into the shallows, he swung the cylindrical chunk of limestone like a club, whacking the fish a mighty blow on its jaw. The barbel's awesome mouth flew open, and Burble shot forward, collapsing in a heap atop Dippler. Dan let go of the stalagmite and leapt to safety, landing upon his two friends in a jumble of thrashing limbs. Like a steel trap, the barbel's mouth slammed shut, trapping the stalagmite in its jaws. It slid backward, completely stunned. Slipping from the shallow rock ledge, the leviathan of the pool dropped back into the depths. Slowly it sank from sight in the green, translucent water, leaving behind a spiraling trail of carmine from its injured mouth. They lay exhausted, shuddering with shock and fear. Dan sat up first, massaging his limbs briskly, wide eyes riveted on the still pool.
Ugh, what an evil-looking monster.
Are you all right, Burb? The irrepressible Vole inspected his skinned tail ruefully.
Yes, yes, 'twas a big 'un all right. Pity we couldn't have dragged it ashore and ate it. I'm starving.
Dan burst into laughter at the gluttonous water Vole.
Ha ha ha! Trust you, Burb, always thinking of your stomach.
Burble shook himself indignantly.
Ah, now, you're wrong there, bucko. I was thinking of the big fish's stomach, and what it'd be like living inside it. But thank you, Dan. That's a useful old club you swung there, yes, yes.
Dippler was in agreement with the water bowl.
Burb's right, though. I'm starving, too. What I wouldn't give for one of old Goody Brim's scones spread with honey and cream.
Dan took a glance at their surroundings.
As for me, all I'd like to see is the sunlight shining on trees and woodland again. This place gives me the creeps.
The three friends lost all sense of night or day in the gloomy caverns deep in the mountain. They followed the course of the river, hoping that somewhere it might flow out into the open. However, there was always the dread in their minds that it would flow into ever deeper underground caves and keep going down. Hunger, cold, and weariness pervaded their bodies, but they strove onward, knowing they could not afford to lie down and sleep in the bitterly low temperatures of the subterranean regions. Dan began bobbing his head slowly from side to side as they progressed along a winding stone corridor. Dippler, who was walking behind him, grumbled,
"Keep your head still, mate. I'm starting to feel dizzy watching you shaking it from one side to t'other all the time."
But Dan continued moving his head.
"I can see a star shining up ahead. Leastways it looks like a star. But maybe 'tis just a vision, I'm so tired."
The shrew pushed his way in front of Dan.
"Let me take a look, mate." "Ha, you're right. There is something glimmering up ahead. Looks a bit like a star. Come on."
Pushing their exhausted limbs, they stumbled ahead. The light grew larger, and then Burble shouted joyfully,
"Yes, yes, I see it clear now. That ain't no star. 'Tis a gleam of daylight. It's daylight, I tell yer."
Renewed energy flooded their bodies, and they ran toward the light, laughing and rubbing their paws together like gleeful dibbins. Leaving the river course, they climbed upward over piles of stony debris, sliding back in the deep, dusty shale. Dan used his sword, digging the blade in and hauling himself up until he reached the light. The young squirrel placed his eye against the hole and peered through.
"I can see the outside. We're on the lower slopes of the mountain at the far side. Stay back and I'll see if I can widen this hole with my sword."
He stabbed at the hole and was immediately rewarded. A big chunk of rocky earth, with grass growing on it and a sprig of heather, tumbled inward. Dippler and Burble moved it out of the way, and sunlight flooded in. They laughed and cried at the same time, letting the warm sun beam in on their dust-grimed faces.
"Yes, yes, that's the good old sun, all right. Go on, Dan, give it a good dig with your blade."
Several more stabs of the sword brought soil, rock, grass, scree, and mountain herbage tipping in upon them. Spitting soil and grit, they climbed out into the sunlit afternoon and sat blinking in the unaccustomed warmth and brightness. Behind them, the mountain reared, high and forbidding. Below was a woodland with a broad stream running through it. Dippler pounded Dan's back, raising a cloud of dust from him.
"We did it, matey. We did it. Now for some victuals. I'll stake me name, there'll be fruit and berries growing aplenty amid those trees down there. What do you say, Burb?"
"Oh, yes, yes, and they'll still be there while we're sitting about on our tails up here looking at 'em. Come on, let's eat."
Stumbling, rolling, and scooting on all fours, they bumbled their way down from the lower mountain slope into the peaceful green canopy of quiet woodland. Dan made a little camp on the stream bank. He found flint in the soil, and used dried moss with his steel sword blade to get a small fire going. Dippler and Burble were soon foraging about.
Ha-ha! Apples and blackberries! Loads of 'em! Yes, yes, I found wild strawberries and a plum tree, too.
They bathed in the warm stream shallows, getting all the dust and dirt of their ordeal out of their fur, drying off around the fire. Dippler shouted out with the sheer joy of being alive, his cheeks swollen with a great mouthful of apple and plum.
Good old Mother Nature! Thanks for the feast, Marm!
With the fire in front of them and the summer sun on their backs, they gorged themselves shamelessly on sweet, ripe fruit. Soon eyelids began drooping, and they tossed the mess of apple cores and plum stones into the stream and lay down gratefully.
Denmate, I'm glad you never died and you're still talking to me, murmured Dippler.
Oh, are you, Dip?
Well, that's nice. But let's remember there's someone missing. Poor Song. Will we ever see her again?
For a moment the two friends were silent. Eventually Dippler put his arm around Dan.
Don't worry. She's a real warrior, that'n. I wouldn't be surprised if one bright morning she doesn't just come strolling by.
Just then they were rudely interrupted.
Will yous both be quiet? Yes, yes. And if you don't go to sleep, I'll kill the two of you and never talk to either of you again.
Lying on their backs in the peaceful noontide, the three weary travelers snored uproariously. It was the snores that betrayed their presence to a creature roaming the woods. Fennel. Dippler was wakened by the point of a rapier pressing against his throat. The Gwasom Shrew opened his eyes to be confronted by his hulking former comrade. Fenno's brutal features split in an ugly grin, and he leaned close to Dippler, keeping his voice low.
You and your mate snore too loud, Gwasom. I had a feeling we'd meet up again someday. Quiet now. One peep out of you and you're dead. We've got a score to settle, me and you.
Despite Fenno's warning, Dippler managed to whisper,
Promise you won't harm my mates?
Fenno stared into Dippler's hard, unfearing eyes.
I ain't promising nothing to you, Dippler. Logalog's little pet, 'twas you started all this trouble for me. Now get up on your paws. Make one false move and I'll slay your friends.
Dippler rose slowly. Behind Fenno he could see Burble still snoring loudly. But Dan had one eye open, and he winked at Dippler. Fenno kept the rapier point pressed to Dippler's throat, so Dan had to be careful of his next move. Rising silently behind Fenno, he suddenly grabbed the big shrew by both ears and pulled him roughly backward. Fenno could not keep his balance and fell flat on his back. Dippler's footpaw was speedily on Fenno's rapier paw, stopping him from wielding the blade. The bullying shrew sneered up at him.
So it takes two of you, eh? Why not wake the other one? Then all three could gang up on me, cowards.
Dippler looked across to Dan, his eyes bleak. Stay out of this, mate. 'Tis my fight. Dan nodded his head, then drew his sword and tossed it over.
So be it, friend. Here, borrow my blade.
Burble sat upright, rubbing his eyes.
Can't a beast get a bit of sleep round here? What's going on?
Dippler caught the sword, cautioning Burble.
Nothing to do with you, Burb. Stay out of it. This is personal.
Dan and Burble moved away from the two shrews, and Dippler took his footpaw from Fenno's rapier. The big shrew sprang upright, swishing his blade.
Now I'm going to slay you like I did old Logalog.
Dippler was unused to the heavier weapon, but he leveled it at his enemy.
You can't kill me like you murdered Logalog. I'm facing you, Fenno. You stabbed Logalog in the back.
They circled each other, blades flickering, each looking for an entrance. Fenno was a skilled sword beast.
I'll chop you to ribbons before you can swing that clumsy thing, he taunted.
Dippler parried his strike awkwardly and stood waiting for the next thrust, trying to accustom his paw to the blade.
You're a bully and a murdering coward, Fenno. You always were.
Fenno swung and feinted. Bringing his rapier slashing down across the young shrew's footpaw, he grinned nastily.
Bit by bit, I'll carve you nice and slow, young'un.
As he spoke, he leapt forward, swinging sideways, aiming across his adversary's eyes. Dippler was ready this time, and he swayed backward, chopping the heavy blade down and breaking Fenno's rapier into two pieces. Fenno was quick. He jumped with both footpaws on the flat of the sword and headbutted Dippler. The young shrew saw stars and fell flat on his back. Fenno grabbed the sword and dived at Dippler. Desperation and a quick turn of speed aided the younger shrew. He rolled over to one side, seizing the broken rapier and leaping upright. Fennel hit the ground in a cloud of dust. Dippler brought the broken rapier down forcefully with both paws as the hefty shrew rolled over. Breathing heavily and hardly able to lift his head, Dippler stood over the body of his enemy.
"Shouldn't have let you turn over, Fennel. I should have gotten you in the back the way you killed Logalog."
Dan retrieved his sword. Kneeling, he examined the hilt of the broken rapier protruding from Fennel.
"Dip, this is your sword. I recognize the hilt."
The young shrew took a glance at it.
"That's my blade, all right. How did that scum come to be carrying it? I lost it back in the caves."
Burbel pondered a moment, then held up a paw.
"Ah, I've got it. Yes, yes. Your rapier wasn't a great heavy blade like Dan's. 'Twill have been swept straight through yon mountain by the river into that stream."
"I'll wager that's where the big shrew feller found it.
On the bed of the stream shallows. Yes, yes."
Dippler picked up the bottom half of the blade and flung it into the stream, where it sank and went rolling away with the current.
"Aye, perhaps you're right, Burb. Doesn't make much difference now, though, does it? No rapier could stand up to the steel and Martin the warrior's blade."
Dan slung his sword over his back, into the belt that carried it.
"Right you are, Dip. The sword ain't been made that could best this blade."
Later that afternoon, they followed the stream bank away from the mountain. The going was easy, and they covered a fair bit of ground by nightfall. Dan was about to suggest they make camp, when Burbel gestured for silence. They stood quiet while Burbel listened. He pointed to an ash.
"Stay there by that tree. I'll be back soon. Keep quiet now, and keep your heads down while I take a look around."
Dan caught Burble's paw.
"Hold hard there, mate. What is it? There's something you're not telling us."
The water vole sniffed the air, his nose pointing downstream.
"I've been smelling a water meadow up ahead for a while now. Yes, yes, I'd know that heavy scent anywhere. But there's something else, Dan. Something not very nice. I don't like it."
The young squirrel unshouldered his sword.
"Well, you're not going alone, Burb. Whatever 'tis, we'll face it together. Come on, stay together and go quietly."
Late afternoon was slipping into evening when they sighted the water meadow on their right. It was landlocked on the near side, though a narrow gap at its far edge filtered out into a river some distance away. The scent of water lilies, crowfoot, and bulrushes, mixed with the smell of rotting vegetation, was heavy on the air. Dippler's voice sounded unusually loud in the sinister stillness that hung over everything.
"Yuck. So that's what you could smell, eh, Burb?"
Burble glanced back at his friends as he pushed forward into a high fern thicket.
"I know. 'Twas something far worse than that."
They navigated a path through the ferns, the ground squelching under their footpaws as they skirted the water meadow. Burble steeled himself and thrust forward from the sheltering ferns.
"Smells stronger now. Somewhere around here. Yah!"
He had walked straight into the half-decayed carcass of a water rat, dangling from the limb of a crack willow, its grinning skull seeming to mock at them through eyeless sockets.
Dan froze. "So that's what you could smell."
Two sharpened bulrush spears came whizzing out of nowhere, one burying itself in the earth alongside Dippler, the other narrowly missing Dan's head. Drums began pounding, and more spears came hissing through the air. Burble glimpsed the horde of lizards, newts, and toads thrashing their way through the watery margin toward them.
"Oh, great seasons of slaughter. Run for it, mates."
Foul-smelling ooze squirted under paw as they fled, flattening ferns and leaping over rotting tree trunks. A fearsome high-pitched wail arose from the reptiles pursuing them, and the drums throbbed louder. Dan made sure that whenever possible, he kept hold of Dippler and Burble's paws as they ran across the marshy ground. Behind them could be heard the slithering and keening of the cold-eyed hunters, growing closer by the moment. Burble stumbled and fell flat in damp brown sedge, spluttering and coughing.
"Run for your lives! I can't go no further!"
Roughly, Dippler dragged the water vole upright. "We're sticking together, mate. Move yourself!" Stumbling and gasping, they dragged Burble along with them. Two toads and a lizard, who had come from a different angle, leapt out in front of them, spears at the ready. Clasping paws, the three companions charged straight at them, tumbling them flat before they had a chance to use their weapons. Dan felt the toad's stomach under paw, the breath whooshing out of the reptile as the young squirrel ran right over him. Into a grove of trees they pounded, dodging between the trunks, bulrush spears clattering off the branches around their heads. Dan knew they could not run much longer, but he staggered onward, looking wildly about for some place to hide. There it was, a huge rotten elm trunk lying flat in a deep, leaf-carpeted depression, which had probably once been a stream.
"Down there, quick, under the fallen tree!"
They flung themselves under the dead woodland giant, quickly scooping out the thick sodden loam and building it around them. Dan pushed the other two farther under, drawing his sword and fighting his way in alongside them. Surrounded by the nauseating odor, regardless of wood lice and insects that crawled over them, they lay, scarcely daring to draw breath, their hearts pounding frantically, hoping fervently that the hunters would not discover them. Moments seemed to stretch into hours. Then Dan heard the rustle of dry leaves. The drums had ceased, and the reptiles had stopped their wailing. Now there were slithering sounds. The pursuers were in the disused stream bed, searching for them. The three friends gripped one another's paws tightly, knowing that twilight had fallen over the area, giving them a slight hope that they might be bypassed. The water meadow dwellers communicated with each other in a series of sibilant hisses and soft clicking noises, no language that the three friends could distinguish. Then they could sense the reptiles on the log above them. A bulrush spear probed into the hiding place, scratched Dippler's back and raked Dan's paw, poked about in the wet underloam, scraped against the log's underside, then withdrew. Dan, Dippler, and Burble lay motionless, knowing that the stream bed was swarming with toads, lizards, and newts. The foul air was stifling. Black mud and a soggy compound of long season's dead leaves pressed in on them. They were trapped. 29. Askrod sat out on the flatlands in front of the abbey. It was a warm, moonless night. The land was still and calm. A shudder of delight shook the Marl Fox. He had solved the problem. Redwall's main gate was only held shut by a long wooden bar set in open-topped holders, two on either side of the double doors. One good push upward by four strong creatures holding a spear through the central crack between the doors would knock the bar out of position. Askrod had spent an hour at twilight, peering into the crack, even testing the theory by quietly shoving in his axe blade and pressing upward. The bar had budged slightly. His plan would work. All that remained was for Predak to return with the army. The Marl Fox listened to the warm toll of Redwall's muted twin bells, softly ringing out the midnight hour. With any luck, Predak would arrive with Vannon, Raventail, and the others in the dawn hour, when all was quiet, and the Redwallers would still be abed, suspecting nothing. Blending with the landscape so that he was almost invisible, he lay flat and watched the night sentries idly patrolling the wall top. By dawn, if they were not relieved, those guards would be practically slumbering. A single skylark began its lone song in the half-light as the vermin army arrived. Under Vannon's directions, they filed along the ditch that ran along the west side of the path outside Redwall. Askrod slid into the ditch, gesturing toward the still figures of the shrews who were acting as wall guards.
"See, just as I figured. They're dozing nicely. I'll wager that apart from a few cooks, that whole abbey is still sleeping."
Raventail pawed keenly at his cutlass.
"Be sure you write this a time, Magic Fox. Kyar."
Askrod shot the ferret a withering glance.
"Don't worry, my ragged friend. My plan will work. All you have to do is follow orders. Leave the thinking to Marl Foxes."
Raventail licked the stained blade of his cutlass.
"Magic Fox give order. Me and my beasts kill plenty."
Predak gave a long, narrow spear to four water rats she had personally selected. Big, rough-looking beasts.
"Right. Let's get it done. You four, follow me and Askrod. Vannon, wait here until you see our signal. One wave of the spear. Then come quick. No yelling war cries and shouting to let them know we're here. Clear?"
Vannon's pale eyes scanned the waiting horde of bandaged and poulticed vermin, making sure they had heard the order.
"Just get the gates open. We'll come silently."
Old Friar Butty had passed a restless night in the gatehouse. It was close to dawn when he guessed the reason he had only slept half the night. He had dozed off and missed supper. The recorder never slept well on an empty stomach. He decided to have a good early breakfast while helping in the kitchen. The ancient squirrel left the gatehouse and began walking across the lawn toward the abbey. But he had scarce gone a score of paces when there was a dull thud, and the gate bar hit the ground. Friar Butty turned and found himself peering through the half-light of dawn at six creatures, two Marl Foxes and four water rats, one of whom was waving a long spear. Dark shapes poured out of the ditch and into the open gateway. Butty ran as fast as his aged limbs would carry him toward the main building, shouting,
Attack! We're being invaded! Sound the alarm!
Russell was up and about early, helping the breakfast cooks. He was coming out of the door with an apple basket in one paw, heading for the orchard, when he heard the cries. The water rat carrying the spear was chasing Buddy, trying to cut him down before he reached the abbey. Racing hard, he was barely a paw's length behind the old recorder when he drew back the spear, ready to stab forward. Russell's apple basket caught him full in the face at the same instant that the squirrel warrior's flying kick struck his stomach. Russell grabbed the spear and flung it, bringing down a ferret who was leading the charge. Seizing Buddy's paw, he dragged him headlong into the abbey and slammed the door shut. Russell's roaring boomed through Great Hall as he shot home the bolts on the big door.
"Wake, Red Wallers! It's an attack! They're inside the grounds!"
Jangler Swifteye came bounding downstairs, furious. "First night we're not on watch, Russ, and they're in!" Gwasom Shrews, Red Wallers, and the Noonvale Players came hurrying into Great Hall, some half-dressed, others still in night attire. Jangler pushed them this way and that, yelling,
"Shove the tables over to the windows and defend them! Troglo, you and Melilot get all the weapons you can muster. Floriot, take your creatures and barricade the door. Guard it. Sister Slowey, see the Dibbons stay upstairs, out of the way. Russell, get to an upstairs window and see what's going on out there, mate."
Craiga Badgermum felt blindly about her until she touched Janglor.
"What can I do to help?"
Alayo and Rimrose took the blind badger's paws.
"You come upstairs with us. We'll see what we can do from the upper windows."
An argument had broken out on the front lawn between Askrod and Raventail. Dawn was up, the rosy glow illuminating the two quarreling creatures.
"Barbarian oaf! I said to come silently when the signal was given."
"Watch you mouth, Magic Fox. We came plenty, plenty quiet. Old Mouse running away did much shoutin'. Kayar, that one shout."
Vannon interrupted the dispute.
"He's right, brother. We charged without a single sound. It was the old Redwaller who alerted them."
Askrod was not in a good mood at their failure to get inside the abbey building. He turned on his sister, snarling.
"Who asked you? There were 8 sentries on that wall, but the stupid ferret and his gang slew 7 of them, so now we only have 1 hostage to bargain with. Perhaps you'd like to side with Raventail and slay him, too."
The Gwasom Shrew man lay on the grass, wounded and bound. He kicked his legs, catching Raventail.
"Aye, go ahead and slay me, Slime Snout. I'm tied up, and you've got me outnumbered. Shouldn't be too hard for a hero like you."
The barbarian ferret began kicking Mayan repeatedly.
"Kayar, I kick you plenty good for that."
Askrod dragged Raventail roughly off the shrew.
"Idiot, you kill that shrew and I'll slay you."
Raventail brandished his cutlass under the Marl Fox's nose.
"Yucka chuck, that'll be the day. Come on, Magic Fox, you want to fight Raventail? Me fight plenty good, Kayar, plenty good."
Predak dragged them apart.
"What's the matter with you two? We should be fighting the Redwallers. Let's concentrate on getting inside the abbey."
Russell came downstairs, grim-faced, to make his report to Janglor.
"They're all over the place out there, and our main gates are wide open. Bardal's dead, and 6 other shrews who were on Walguard.
They've got Mayan. He's still alive.
What do we do?"
Janglor sat on the bottom stairs, gnawing at his lip.
"Well, we can't break out and fight them. They've got us far outnumbered, matey.
Then there's the Oldens and the Dibbons to think of.
Looks like they've got us boxed in."
Florian was crossing the hall. Shards of crystal glass exploded on the floorstones around him, and the hare dodged quickly to one side, his ears standing up with indignation.
"They're slinging stones at the windows! Vandals! Wreckers!"
He spread it across to one of the tables set by the windows. Leaping upon it, he began returning the stones that had fallen on the table.
"Scruffy-necked bog splatchers, take that, and that too! Ha-ha! I say, you chaps, I got one, right in the fizzog, what?"
Jangler whipped the sling from around his waist.
"Well done, Mr. Florian. That's what we can do, Russ. Strike back at him. Let me at the scum."
Redwallers lined the broken windows, slinging stones and hurling anything that came to paw at the attackers. However, the vermin fought back with sling stones, spears, and arrows. Jangler stooped to help a mole who had been hit by a spear, only to find that he was dead. The squirrel warrior gritted his teeth, calling out to his friend,
"Russell, go and get those longbows."
Russell came hurrying back with bows and quivers.
"One of them's missing, Jang. I can only find 2. Wish old Skipper was here to lend a paw. He could shoot a bow, that'n."
Jangler set shaft to bowstring, and standing tall, fired through the broken panes. From outside came a scream.
"So can I when I'm roused, mate, so can I." A dozen or more vermin lay transfixed by arrows when Askarad decided to drop back a bit. He called a halt and ordered a large fire to be lit in the center of the lawn. When it was blazing, he stood boldly in front of it and hailed the abbey.
Redwallers, listen to me. You're surrounded. Come out.
Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop gave the answer.
Come out? Never, sir. Why don't you come in and get us, what? We could come in and get you if we wait long enough. But by then there'd be a lot of you dead, and your young ones would be starving. If you don't come out immediately, we'll kill the prisoner we took.
Without turning his head, he addressed his next remark to Vannon.
Bring the shrew over here.
Jangler sat on the table edge, looked at Russell, then placed his head in both paws.
I don't want to see or hear any of this, mate. You know what they'll do to poor old man.
At a dormitory window, the missing longbow was in the paws of the blind badger Krega. Rimrose was amazed. She had never seen a longbow drawn so far back. The arrow was stretched to its very tip on the string. Krega kept her face straight ahead, listening to Elio.
Down a bit and left, Krega. Now up a touch, just a mite. That's it. The shaft's well lined on that villain's head.
The badger released the string with a mighty twang. The arrow carried on, straight through the fire, across the lawn, and out through the open gates onto the flatlands, despite the fact that Askarad was the first target it passed through. Raventail snatched up a bow and thrust a rag-bound arrow into the fire to set it alight. Troglo's spearback ducked as the blazing shaft zipped in through a broken window. Raventail's horrendous message fell upon the Redwaller's ears as he screeched savagely,
"Burn, Redwall! Kayar! Burn, burn, burn!"
Cutting dark, smoking trails, flaming arrows began whirring in through the windows. Formal Gubbio alerted his crew.
"Hur! Giddy buckets of water and wetted sacks! Asen now!"
Russell stared ashen-faced at Florian and Janglor.
"They means to burn this abbey down with us in it."
Another volley of blazing shafts came flying in. Redwallers dashed hither and thither amid the smoke, dodging arrows and flapping away at burning tapestry hangings with wet sacks. Formal and his crew were trying to set up a bucket chain from Great Hall to the kitchens, but the mole leader shook his velvety head in despair as he passed buckets of water.
"Hur, lackaday, us'n's going to run short of water soon."
Krega came pounding downstairs to hold a hasty conference with Janglor and Russell. They agreed with her plan immediately. Janglor ordered the scheme into action, quietly and without fuss.
"Splicker, arm your shrews. Troglo, get all the able-bodied Redwallers together and see they have weapons. Mr. Florian, go to the windows and tell them we're coming out."
Florian leapt up on the table, calling to the attackers.
"Truce, you chaps! I say truce! You can pack in trying to burn the old place. We're coming out. Hold your fire!"
Predak signaled the archers to cease firing and called back to the abbey dwellers.
"Come out unarmed, all of you, right now, or I'll order the archers to double their fire."
Florian's head popped into the frame of a broken window.
"Keep your shirt on, Marlfox. We've got wounded and young'uns to carry out. Just give us a tick, and we'll be there."
A pitifully small group had gathered by the door, armed with anything that came to paw. Krega placed her paws about Jangler and Russell.
"You're sure you want to do this, my friends?"
Jangler's hooded eyes gazed levelly at the big blind badger.
"Wouldn't have it no other way, Marm. You just hold that door and stop 'em getting to those inside here."
Krega's great striped head nodded solemnly.
"Never fear, Jangler, Swift Eye. I'll hold the door as long as Redwall Abbey stands. It has been a pleasure knowing you."
Jangler bowed gallantly.
"The pleasure was all mine, Marm. Open the door, Raguba."
Raventail watched as the abbey door opened slowly. No more than 20 Redwallers filed out, but he saw the glint of weaponry as the door closed behind them. There they stood, facing the foe beast in the morning sun. The barbarian ferret grinned in anticipation.
"Kayar, they beasts come out to make fight."
Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop had momentarily forgotten all his dramatic eloquence and posturing. He raised a sharpened window pole and roared as he began to dash forward.
"Charge!"
And charge they did, giving full voice to the time-honored war cries as they hurtled toward the vermin army.
"Raguba! Log a log a log a log! Red Wall!"
Vannon stood confidently, watching them come. The vixen drew her axe, remarking to Predak,
"So the day of reckoning has finally come. Now they will pay with their miserable lives..."
The Marrow Fox fell halfway to the ground, propped up by the otter javelin that had slain her. Otter crews from far and wide charged over the abbey lawns, headed by Skipper.
"Give 'em blood and vinegar, mates! Red Wall!"
They flung themselves upon the foe beast like a mighty tidal wave, engulfing all in its path. Big, brawny otters, both male and female, tribal tattoos decorating the sinewy paws that wielded sling, javelin, and longblade. A rousing cheer rang from the abbey's dormitory windows as Dibbons and elders shouted their heroes on to victory.
"Give 'em glug and vinegar, Mr. Flory! Come on, Jangler, my big fat son! Show 'em you're a swift eye! Her, you 'em give 'em billios or skip! Rustful, matey! That marl fox is sneaking away! Quick!"
Predak had almost made it to the gatehouse when Rustful came pounding up. The vixen slipped up the west wall steps, shedding her cloak and causing the squirrel warrior to trip on it. She dashed along the battlements, straight into the waiting grasp of the otter Boracle. He set his paws in a death grip around the marl fox's neck.
"Now you must pay for killing my brother Elikim."
Raventail fought like a demon until he was backed up against the abbey door. Florian could not resist stretching past the ferret chieftain and striking the door with his pole.
"Vermin leader outside, come to call on you, marm, what?"
The door opened slightly. Raventail managed a whimper of fear as Krega's paws shot out and snatched him inside. That was the last any beast ever saw of the barbarian Raventail, alive. Skipper dashed up to the wall top and waved his javelin.
"You vermin, throw down your weapons, and you'll be spared."
"Right, mates, surround them and pen them at the northwest corner. Slay any who still want to fight."
The remaining vermin hastily threw away their weapons. They were herded into the wall corner, where they sat, paws upon heads. Skipper was about to come downstairs when he noticed Boracle lounging against the battlements.
"Aye, aye, matey. What happened to your marl fox?"
The Noonvale otter shrugged, glancing over the wall.
"Vanished. You know the way marl foxes can disappear, Skip?"
Skipper knew it was a long drop from the battlements to the ground below. He nodded at Boracle, straight-faced.
"Aye, I know how marl foxes disappear."
Friar Buddy watched the apprehensive faces of the 20 wretched vermin who had thrown down their arms. The recorder's voice was stern.
"You have no need to fear. We at Redwall keep our word. Your lives are spared, which is more than you or your masters would have done for us, had you won the battle. We do not have prisoners or slaves at our abbey, so you will be released. You will be split up into 8 groups and let free at different times. 5 to go one way, 5 to go another, until Redwall is rid of your presence. Brother Melilot will give you each 2 days' provisions. That is all."
Florian Duggawolf Wolfachop, restored to his ebullient self, checked Buddy.
"No, no, it ain't, begging your pardon, Friar, sir. Allow me a word with these malicious miscreants, will you?"
"My thanks."
"Right. Listen up, scurvy vermin types. Pay attention at the back there. You will clean this abbey and its grounds thoroughly before I allow you to leave, understood? All together now. Say yes, sir."
The reply was half-hearted. Florian wagged his cane at them.
"Not good enough, you villainous chaps. Now speak up, or I'll come amongst you and liven up your ideas a bit, what?
Mayen stumped up, a poultice bandaged on his shoulder. The tough Gwasom shrew winked at Florian.
"I'll lend your paw, sir. I can see one or two rascals here who aimed kicks and blows upon me earlier today. Now listen to me, you cowardly lot. I ain't tender-hearted like Mr. Florian. So if I gives you an order, you'd best jump to it, or I'll make you wish you'd been slayed in the battle. Understood? Let me hear you all say yes, sir."
The mass reply was crisp and clear, as if with one voice.
"Yes, sir."
Jangler and Rustful sat with Rimrose and Elio in the orchard, listening as Krega explained everything to the Abbey Dibbons.
"You're all safe now, my little ones, and so is Redwall. Once again we can live in peace and good order. Bad creatures tried to take our abbey from us, and we had to do battle with them to preserve our way of life."
Dwaffle wrinkled his tiny nose.
"Thara, why Mr. Flory and Jang and Rustful and Toglo was slaying all the vermits out on the lawn. I know liked that. I was frightened.
Good job Skip comed with all hotters."
Krega nodded in the mouse babe's direction.
"None of us liked it, Dwaffle, but we had to do it. Either that or let those evil creatures capture our abbey. But now there is a lot of mending to do."
Wugger, the mole babe, piped up helpfully. Usens do he mendin', marm. Me and Doppel get big ammer, and he nailers. Fix habby all good. Bangity bang bang.
Reaching out, Krega took Wugger upon her lap.
That's very kind of you, sir. But there are lots of different kinds of mending. Broken hearts, bad memories, hasty tempers, and departed friends. All of these need seeing to, before the peace and the seasons grow upon us like soft moss and smooth all the edges of war away, so that you may sleep safe and calm in your beds at night.
Rimrose sat holding Jangler and Elayo's paws. She sniffed, unable to check the tear that strayed from her eye.
If only our song were here. Where do you suppose she and her young friends are now?
Krega lifted her head in the direction of the squirrel wife's voice.
I have dreamed that they will be back before the autumn leaves come down. Don't worry. Wherever your daughter and Dan are, and young Dippler too, I'll wager they're either impressing some beast with their good manners, or giving a fine account of themselves. Those three are a tribute to their upbringing, wherever they are.
30. It was night at the margin of the water meadow. Dan lay crushed beneath the rotten elm trunk, listening to the noise above. It became so loud that he was able to whisper to his friends,
I wonder what all the din's about.
Dippler spat out dead leaves and grit.
We ain't fooling no beast, mate. Our tracks lead right to this tree. I bet they're doing some kind of victory dance up there, probably getting the cook pot ready for us.
Burble was inclined to agree with his shrew friend.
Yes, yes. Sad but true, I say. Still, I think it'd be better getting captured by some old reptiles than laying under this rotten stinking thing all night. It's worse than when we was hiding up the creek from the river heads. Wait, what's that?
Dan listened carefully.
Silence, that's what it is, Burb, silence. Maybe they didn't know we were here after all.
What do you think? Shall we go out and take a look?
Dippler started scrabbling at the soggy loam to free himself. Anything's better than this. Lead the way, Dan.
The dried-up stream bed was deserted, save for the carcasses of several reptiles. The three friends hurried off into the undergrowth, where they sat wiping themselves down and breathing the sweet night air gratefully. Burble tugged a woodlouse from his fur.
Away with your wriggly thing. I ain't no rotten tree trunk.
Well, 'tis thanks to whoever drove the reptiles off back there, yes, yes. 1,000 thanks.
Ah, save your thanks, laddie. There may still be some of these slithery reptiles aboot.
An osprey emerged from the bushes. Surveying them with a distinct twinkle in his rather fierce eyes, he raised his beak and called,
"Or here! They're sair bedraggled and stinky, tay, but they're o'er here!"
There was a lot of bush rustling and paw steps, and then, unbelievably, a figure they'd lost hope of ever seeing again emerged from the undergrowth at a full dash and threw herself upon them, bowling them over in a laughing, joyful heap.
"Song! Ha, ha, ha! So here you are, you foul-smelling, lovely creatures!"
A fat, stern old squirrel and a big, rough female hedgehog hauled Song swiftly off her companions. Dan, Dippler, and Burble lay sprawled on the ground as the old squirrel wagged a paw at Song.
"No time for that now, Missy. Let's get 'em out of here. You can introduce us when we're downriver."
"Phew! And downwind of 'em, too. They smell pretty ripe." Song glanced at the muddy state she herself was in from embracing her lost friends, and turned to the old squirrel.
"Looks like I'll have to take a bath too, Grandpa."
There were more hedgehogs, over a dozen of them, hulking, rough-looking beasts. They surrounded the friends as the party hurried off through the woodland at the water meadow's edge. Dan trotted alongside Song, amazed by the turn events had taken.
"Did I hear you call that old squirrel Grandpa?"
"You surely did. Soon as I saw him, I recognized those lazy eyes. He's my father's father, Gaujo Swifteye. Take a look at him yourself. He's much older than my dad, of course, but you'll see the resemblance is unmistakable." Dan snatched a peep at Gaujo as he turned to converse with the leading hedgehog.
"Aye, now I see him properly. The likeness is clear. Who's the big rough-looking hedgehog he was talking to?"
"I know you'll never believe this, Dan, but she's my aunt." Dan stumbled and almost fell.
"Your aunt?"
Song was still smiling as they trotted steadily through the night-shadowed woodlands.
"Aye, my Aunt Torab. It's a long and complicated story, but here's roughly what happened. My Grandpa Gaujo was a prisoner on the island in the secret lake for many seasons, but he managed to escape.
says he's the only beast who ever did. Anyhow, he made it back to the mainland, but he was completely lost. Then he stumbled upon Torab and her band of friends, 14 in all, half-grown young hedgehogs from 3 different families. Their parents had been slain by marl foxes. Grandpa had lost his family, too. He didn't know where Elayo and little Jangler had got to. So he became their dad, and has lived with them ever since. And McGraw and I just bumped into them yesterday. I still can't quite believe it. The odd-looking group had now reached the river on the water meadow's far fringes, and they turned south along the bank. Dippler looked back fearfully at the huge osprey hobbling in the rear, protecting the group's back. "I hope that big fish eagle's on our side, Song." The young squirrel maid winked at the apprehensive shrew. "That's the mighty McGraw. I have trouble understanding all he says, but since we went over the falls together, we've become the best of pals. You'll like him, Dip. You will too, Burb, once you get to know him." The water vole glanced back at the fierce-eyed McGraw.
Yes, Missy, I'm sure I will. 'Tis a fine, powerful bird he is. We'll have to keep him well-fed, though. Yes. I'd hate to be around when that feller feels hungry."
They halted before dawn at a hidden inlet. A screen of bushes and trees was pulled aside, and Dan, Dippler, and Burble gave a delighted shout.
"The swallow!"
The beautiful little boat was in the process of being repaired. It stood upside down on the wide planked deck of a sprawling hedgehog raft. Turab and the hedgehogs were about to dash aboard when Gojo held forth a javelin, barring their way.
"Remember your manners. We've got guests."
Turab made an impatient curtsy to the friends.
"Prithee, come ye aboard and welcome."
Once they were aboard, the hedgehogs charged onto the raft and fought to get through the narrow doorway of a big cabin built to the vessel's center. Gojo shook his head wearily.
"Back! Get back, all of you. Now what have I taught you?"
Sheepishly, the big spiky beast stood away from the cabin door, the males bowing reluctantly to the females.
"Marm, I pray thee enter."
Once Turab and the other hogmaids were inside, the males began fighting each other in the doorway again. Gojo smiled.
"You'll have to excuse them. They're fine hogs, but they love to fight." "Huh. The trouble I had rearing them was no beast's business. A squirrel dad with 14 hedgehog sons and daughters? Who'd believe it? Still, I got me a pretty young granddaughter now, so things are looking up, eh, Song?"
Song hugged her grandpa, while Dan looked the swallow over.
"How did you find her, sir?"
Gojo stroked the sleek resin-varnished hull. "Swept down river out of the mountains, she was. Full of holes and almost broken 2 pieces.
That's why we were searching round the water meadow. I figured if you were still alive, then that'd be the place you'd land in. Enough jawing now, you young'uns. Time to eat. But first you must jump in the creek and wash the dirt off. You ain't coming to my table smelling the ways you do. McGraw!"
The osprey waddled up and dealt Song a buffet with his good wing, toppling her over the deck rail into the water.
"Again you'll get a good scrub, lassie. Who's next, eh?"
However, before he could raise his wing again, Dan, Dippler, and Burble had thrown themselves into the water.
"Ah, now, you've no need to be helping us in, sir. We'll be after scrubbing ourselves, thank you, yes.
Morning sunlight streamed through the cabin's 2 unshuttered windows as they took breakfast with Gojo Swifteye and the hedgehogs. The food was good, hot cornbread with hazelnuts and apple baked into it, and a salad of celery, lettuce, shredded carrot, and white button mushrooms, with beakers of hot mint and dandelion tea to wash it down. McGraw took himself out into the river for a fish breakfast. Gojo peeled a fat pear with his dagger, outlining his future plans to the reunited friends.
"Every beast I've come across has a score to settle with the marl fox brood. Myself, Turab and the family, McGraw and yourselves. So I've decided that the time's come when we travel over to that island. Queen Silth and her offspring have come to the end of their bullying, thieving, murdering rule. I'm out to clear the earth of their blight."
Turab stared at Gojo over a steaming beaker of tea.
"Thou hast tried it before, father. 'Tis too difficult."
Gojo tapped the tabletop with his dagger.
"Aye, we've always been defeated. Not by the marl foxes, but by the lake. A day and night's long sail, with the water teeming with pike, and that Athrock and his magpies patrolling the skies. The marl foxes were always waiting with their water rats, once we'd been sighted by magpies, and they could stand us offshore with arrow and sling, until we were forced to turn back. by the Fir and Fang. If only I could get onto that island and free the slaves, we'd overrun Sylth and her forces. I never figured how to do it until my pretty song arrived with her secret weapon.
The squirrel maid put aside her food.
You mean our eagle, McGraw?
But, Grandpa, he can't fly.
Gojo's lazy hooded eyes flickered.
Are you sure, my young beauty? I've been watching your eagle. There ain't a pinion feather missing from his wing, and 'tis not broken anywhere along its length, that wing. I've studied the way McGraw carries it, sort of flopped down and still. Now, I know more about fixing injuries than most beasts. Ask Torob and her crew. The fish eagle's wing's not broken. 'Tis dislocated, where it meets the bird's body. I can reset the wing, put it back in its right place, so he can fly again.
Do you know say, Gojo? Well, I'm willing to try it, if it'll make my wing able to fly again.
McGraw had been standing near the cabin door, listening to what Song's grandpa was saying. He ambled in, his savage golden eyes flashing.
I'd like it fine to get my beak and talons into yon magpies what did this to me. So tell us the rest of your grand plan, y'all tree-hopper.
The creatures in the cabin crowded around the table as Gojo Swifteye outlined his scheme, sketching on the tabletop with the point of his dagger. It was a risky proposition, calling for stout hearts and warriors who would not flinch from danger, but it was a good plan. Song watched her grandpa, the stern face and lazy eyes, deceptively quiet voice and perilous easygoing manner. Recalling Jangler Swifteye, her own father, she knew now where he had inherited his bravery and skill as a warrior. Pride flooded through the young squirrel maid. Swifteyes were a breed of creatures to be reckoned with. An otter and an aged mouse watched from the slave pens in the courtyard of Castle Marl as the funeral procession of Queen Sylth passed by. In the lead strode the Marl fox Lontour, clad in a purple velvet cloak trimmed with silver. She wore a polished wood mask with grieving features etched upon it. Behind her marched the elite guard, armored in shining black, purple pennants hanging from their spear points and shield bosses, blacked with fire smoke. Next came the palanquin, draped with white silk curtains, inside which rested the body of the High Queen Sylth, founder of the Marl Fox dynasty, wrapped tight in the cloth that had once masqueraded as the White Ghost. The entire thing was borne on the shoulders of 60 paw soldiers with bowed heads and measured steps. All around and about the procession, Athrok and his magpies flew, carrying weeping willow twigs in their claws and cawing harshly over the sound of musicians playing dirges on flutes in time to a steady drumbeat. The otter shook his head in disgust, whispering to the old mouse,
"Look at that and walking in front, Lontour.
Ha! She's laughing behind that mask, matey. I'd wager a season's victuals on it. What a sham it all is. Every beast on the island knows Lontour killed her own mother. Take my word for it, Cully. There ain't a beast walks under the sun wickeder than a marl fox."
The aged mouse tugged his otter friend's whiskers.
"Stow that kind of talk, pal. If Wilka or Ulleg hears you, they'll have your ed for sure."
Banks of torches blazed on the plateau at the lake edge where the bearers set the palanquin down. Musicians ceased their playing, and Athrok's magpies fell silent as they perched on the nearby rocks. All that could be heard were the fathomless waters lapping at the steep island sides and night breezes causing the torchlights to whir softly. The water rat Wilka stepped forward and presented Lontour with a scroll, specially written for the occasion. The Marl Fox unrolled it ceremoniously and read its contents in a voice artistically choked with emotion.
"No more on our isle will your presence be, or your voice sound like some silver bell. Like summer smoke you have gone from me. My grief is too mournful to tell. Great High Queen Sylth, we commend you with loving care to the deep. May the guardians of waters attend you in silent depths of sleep, knowing that I, who rule in your place, draw all of my wisdom from you. May show to all a merciful face, to your memory always true."
Ulleg, the former slave captain, took 3 paces forward, signaling with his spear point to the bearers standing immediately behind the palanquin. They lifted the rear carrying pole slowly as the music started again. Tilting at a forward angle, the palanquin was raised above the bearers' heads. White silk hangings at the palanquin's front blossomed out,
and Silth's wrapped body slid with a dull splosh into the lake. The body had been weighted with stones and sank down into the dark waters. All was calm for a brief moment. Then the long, sleek glint of pike flashed in the torchlight as the ever-ravenous predators rushed to the spot and shot down into the deeps, pursuing the grisly object. Lantor removed her mask, and spreading both paws wide over the waters, she called out in a high-pitched whine,
"High Queen Silth is dead!"
Immediately Wilka and Ullig shouted aloud,
"Long live High Queen Lantor! Long live High Queen Lantor!"
The cry was taken up by the attendant crowd of water rats until it became a chant. Lantor inclined her head to one side, smiling shyly, as Ullig gestured for silence.
"What can I say to you, my loyal subjects? I accept."
Ullig and Wilka were about to lead the cheering when the logboat nosed up to the plateau and Mokun leapt ashore. Mokun had been watching as usual. He never made a move without first studying the situation shrewdly. From out on the lake, he had seen his mother's body being committed to the deep. Making for those he knew to be the two main conspirators, Mokun seized Ullig and Wilka by their throats. They blanched in fear. Mokun spoke in a low, grating tone, so none but the two water rats could hear.
"So this is how you sell out behind my back. Shut up and listen hard. When I give you the nod, both of you get every beast shouting, and here's what you'll shout."
Lantor was beginning to feel uneasy. Of all her brothers and sisters, Mokun was the slyest of marl foxes. She watched him carefully. He came to her, his face wreathed in smiles, and clasping her paws, he shook them joyfully.
"My little sister, High Queen Lantor, what a happy homecoming for me!"
Lantor tried to break Mokun's grip on her paws, but he was far too strong. He clasped her more tightly.
"What fortune that I should return the very moment you are proclaimed queen! Alas, I knew our poor mother's days were numbered, but she'll rest peacefully, knowing she has you to rule in her stead. But wait, I brought back a thing of great beauty for our mother. It shall be my gift to you, High Queen. Here, let me show it to you."
While he had been talking, Mokun had maneuvered Lantor to the edge of the rock plateau. He called out to the rats who were dumbly sitting in the logboat, awaiting orders.
"Open the tapestry. Spread it wide. Captain Ullig, tell your bearers to bring forward the torches. Let every beast see the prize I have brought from afar to celebrate the start of High Queen Lantor's reign."
The onlookers gasped in wonderment as the fantastically woven tapestry of Martin the Warrior was unrolled in the torchlight. All eyes were upon it when Mokun made his move. With a quick flick of his paws, he pushed Lantor into the lake. She screamed once, thrashing about in the wet shreds of her mother's shroud, which were floating up to the surface. Had she remained still, Lantor might have been pulled to safety. But anything that moved in the waters was fair game to the pike shoals that hunted there. The lake water boiled briefly as the heavy predators struck. Then Lantor was gone. Mokun nodded to Wilka and Ullig, and they shouted as though their lives depended upon it, which indeed they did.
"A sign! 'Tis a sign! Mokun is the rightful ruler! Hail High King Mokun! Hail High King Mokun!"
The last marl fox of all turned to face his army with a look combining tragedy, innocence, and surprise.
"She slipped. I tried my best to hold on to her, but she slipped. Alas, I could do nothing to save her. Lantor was taken by the spirit of the lake."
Wilka and Ullig appealed to the crowd.
"'Tis a sign. The lake judged her unfit. Aye, Mokun rules. Hail High King Mokun!"
Soon every beast joined in, shouting themselves hoarse until the din rang across the island. In the slave pens, the otter shook his head woefully at the aged mouse.
"So that one's back, eh? I wonder how Mokun murdered the murderer. I think I'd sooner be a slave than a marl fox. You live a little longer."
The old mouse shrugged, resting his head against the bars.
"Don't be too sure of it, pal. How long do you think we're going to last with Mokun as king around here?"
31. Morning sunlight shimmered on the river. McGraw, balanced on the rail of the raft, watched by every beast aboard. The osprey flapped his reset wing experimentally. Then, slightly doubtful, he set his fierce eye upon Gojo.
"My wing still hurts. Are you sure that's fixed?" "Sure I'm sure," the old squirrel warrior assured his patient. The wing's bound to hurt, to stiff through being idle. You'll have to try using it. Go on.
McGraw launched himself from the rail, flapping madly. He flew a short distance, then crashed into the river. Torob and Song extended a long punting pole to him, and McGraw grabbed it in his beak, allowing himself to be pulled up onto the bank. He stood shaking water from his plumage.
Ugh, I can fly. I'm sure of it. But your lot are making me nervous, standing there watching me. Gang about your business, and leave me to myself.
Sure, I've seen everything now, Burble muttered to one of the big hedgehogs. An eagle who's too shy to fly. Yes, yes, that's the blinkin' limit.
Dan threw a paw about the water bowl's shoulders. Oh, let him be, Burb. Come on, Torob and the gang are going to show us how to make hodgepodge pie. In the cabin, the hedgehogs were tossing anything they could find into a cauldron, which sat squarely atop a pot-bellied stove. The four friends had never seen anything like it. Torob and her gang went at the business of making hodgepodge pie with wild abandon, singing in gruff, off-key voices. What they lacked in melodiousness, they made up for in volume. Gojo had heard it all before, and he clapped both paws over his ears to gain a little peace.
Oh, you take an odge, and I'll take a podge. If any beast asks us why, just tell him that some clever cooks are making hodgepodge pie. We start with an hazelnut and a leek, cause they're what we likes best, and though they don't look much to speak till we toss in the rest, hodgepodge, hodgepodge, good old hodgepodge, that's the pie for me. I'll scoff it hot at supper time, or woof it cold for tea. Oh, savage a cabbage, tear a turnip, rip-ripe radishes too. Chop up chestnuts, they're the best nuts, chuck in quite a few. Dandelion, ransom, mushrooms, ansom, beetroots nice and red, and watercress that's more or less, with pie crust over head. Oh, hodgepodge, hodgepodge, good old hodgepodge, northwest, east, or south. You can shove it up your nose, but I suppose 'tis better off in your mouth. Who loves an hodgepodge? Hedgehogs!
Surprisingly enough, when it was served at midday, it looked good and tasted even better. Gojo fought the hedgehogs off, rapping paws with his ladle and muttering darkly about manners. Then he dug through the thick golden pie crust and ladled out portions to them all, steaming hot and delicious. Dipper scraped his platter clean and winked at Torob.
Great stuff. I'll have to remember that recipe. What's it called?
Podge, podge, pie?
Yakarig!
A blood-curdling scream caused them to leap from their chairs. Gojo went racing out of the cabin, dagger at the ready.
Sounds like something being torn apart by wild beasts.
Hustling and shoving, they piled out onto the deck of the raft. The wild cry cleaved the air once more, and a dark shadow fell over them, causing every beast to duck as something large hurtled by. Song was knocked flat on her back, but she lay there pointing skyward, shouting with joy.
It's the mighty McGraw! Look, he's flying!
With his tremendous wingspread stretching, closing, backing and flapping, the osprey flew as none had ever seen such a big bird fly. Soaring, wheeling, plummeting, and twirling out of dives like a corkscrew, McGraw put on an exhibition of flight for his earthbound friends, sometimes skimming so low that his wing pinions clipped their ears. Song felt her heart soar with the eagle. She was thrilled that his wing was healed due to her grandpa's skill.
Go on, McGraw! Fly, fly, fly!
And McGraw did just that. Winging up into the blue until he was a mere speck in the summer sky, he turned and did several victory rolls. Folding both wings tight to his side, the eagle dropped like a thunderbolt toward the raft. And for a breathless moment, Song thought he would smash into the deck. But he spread his wings again, and the mighty talons shot out as he swooped and landed on the rail, where he stood with both wings spread to their extent. For the first time since she had met her friend, Song saw the fish eagle in his element. Filled with the exhilaration of his own savage strength, McGraw flapped his wings, shouting aloud his challenge.
I'm the eagle which can outfly a lightning flash. My egg was broken by the thunderstorm. Kariga! McGraw rules the skies to the world's edge. These talons are mighty, McGraw. Quid plow a field of rocks. Oh, weep, you foe beast. There's a braw bonny bird a-coming your way. Karag!
Gojo nodded in admiration of McGraw's brave display.
I take it you're about ready to go to the lake?
The fierce golden eye winked at him.
Aye, laddie.
I ken you'll be coming wi' me?"
Gorgo Swifteye picked up a long raft pole. He nodded at McGraw and his crew.
"This very day?"
Out on the river it was broad and fast-flowing. The hedgehogs would not let Song or her friends use the raft poles, so they worked on the Swallow, putting the finishing touches to their sleek craft. Torob and the others formed two lines, port and starboard, and they punted deep with their poles. Gorgo sat on the stern rail, using a broad paddle as a rudder to steer the sprawling vessel. By mid-noon they were cruising free along a wide, calm stretch, while the crew sat eating cold hodgepodge pie and drinking cider, watching the raft drift steadily downriver. Song joined her grandpa at the stern rail and showed him her parchment, torn, tattered, and barely decipherable from the batterings it had endured.
"Grandpa, 'tis not very clear now, but there were a few lines of the rhyme here. Let me see now. Ah, here it is. 'And should you live to seek the lake, watch for the fish of blue and gray. Betwixt those two's the path you take, good fortune wend you on your way.'"
Gojo's hooded eyes scanned the waters ahead.
"Aye, the fish of blue and gray. I know 'em well. You'll see those fish afore twilight.
I'll say nothing, pretty one. See if you can spot 'em. You're young and sharp." Twilight came as a relief after the long hot day, gold and crimson flakes of dying sunlight dancing on the waters. Song had positioned herself on the forward rail of the raft. She watched keenly from side to side, taking in all, searching for the signs. From the cabin window she could see Grandpa Gojo and her friends observing her. The young squirrel maid paid attention to the tiniest details, rocks lining the banks, trees growing either side, any patches of bare earth. Then she sighted the fork ahead, a rock that was so large it was almost an island in mid-river, causing the waters to part and run both sides of it. The left fork wound off sharply east, the right one curving slightly west, but farther down river straightening to flow due south. It was on the right fork of the island rock that Song spotted the fish. It was a natural spur of the grayish-hued rock, sticking out at an awkward angle, high up. Curiously, it closely resembled a trout, for the shrubbery growing atop it looked like the fish's small dorsal fin. Where the eye would be positioned, there was a crack in the stone, with a thick spray of delicate blue-flowering wall speedwell growing out of it.
"Ahoy, me beauty!" Gojo called from the cabin window. "Which course do we steer? Has the fish showed you yet?"
Without turning, Song held up her right paw.
"Take the west fork and sail due south, Grandpa."
Gojo chuckled as he emerged from the cabin to attend his steering paddle at the stern.
"You're a born Swifteye, gal. West and south it is."
Night had fallen when the lake came into view. The river was running steep and fast, with outcrops of rock poking dangerously from its surface. Gojo gave the order to his crew.
"All paws on deck. Pole her over these rapids and keep your eyes peeled for those rocks. Lively now."
Song and her companions found themselves standing alongside the burly hedgehogs, pushing and punting with the long raft poles. Burble was slightly tardy, lifting his pole, and was thrust up into the air, the raft rushing by him. Dippler saw him rise and shouted a warning.
"Water bowl overboard! Up in the air!"
Torob and one of her burly sisters were aft. They snatched Burble and the pole, heaving them back onto the deck before he was left clinging to a pole in mid-river as the raft went on without him. Song and her friends were laughing about it when the big craft began to buck and plunge. A hedgehog shot by, looping them all to the raft with a stout rope. Spray struck their faces, and Dan yelled above the den,
"Look out, here we go, mates!"
Song would have been frightened, had it not been for the confidence she felt and the skill shown by her grandpa and Torob's crew. Instead, a wave of exhilaration swept over her as the raft virtually flew down the rapids. Turning and heaving, sometimes head down, other times bow up, night-dark water crested with star-swept spray rushed by in a blur. McGraw balanced firmly on the forward rail, calling directions.
"Rocks coming up ahead. Swing to your left. Left, left! No, awa right a wee bitty. Hold her steady, laddies, steady!"
Without warning, a waterfall came up, and they shot straight over the top, right out into space. The breath was whipped from their mouths as they stood frozen, still holding on to the raft poles, water roaring at their back.
Rack!
The raft landed flat with an ear-splitting splash.
Gojo wiped water from his eyes and shrugged carelessly.
"Well, this is the lake. We've arrived."
Even in the darkness, they could feel the immensity of a vast body of water, calm and smooth as a mill pond in the warm summer night. Every beast aboard collapsed into a sitting position, dog-weary and gasping. Gojo was first to recover, and he paced the deck sternly.
"Come on, me babies, up on your paws. We're sticking out like a bandaged ear if an any foe beast shows up. Let's get her ashore and into some cover. Jump to it, crew."
They chose a spot farther east on the lake shore, where trees grew thick, willows on the fringes dipping their branches into the water. Waist-deep in the lake, they levered the raft on shore with the punting poles. Burble stumbled and spat out a mouthful of muddy liquid.
"A proper old slave driver that grandpa of yours is, Song. Yes, yes, a right old whipcracker."
Gojo's hooded eyes appeared over the stern, staring straight at the grumbling water bowl.
"What was that you were burbling about, Burble?"
"'Twas nothing, sir. Yes, yes, nothing. We're all doing a fine grand job down here, enjoying ourselves, yes."
Dawn was streaking the lake with beige and pink amid low-lying cloud banks. The stillness was eerie. There were no sounds of singing birds over the far-reaching inland sea. From stem to stern, the raft was covered with boughs and fronds, tufts of vegetation and shrubs. Song thrust a final willow bough into the cabin chimney top and climbed wearily down to the deck. She threw her grandpa a limp salute.
"All covered, sir. Permission to sleep."
A smile hovered around Gojo's slanted eyes as he nodded at the exhausted crew. They had worked hard and well.
Well, all right. Permission granted. You can all sleep standing on your heads with one eye open."
Dippler bit his lip with feigned emotion.
"Oh, sir, you're too kind to us ungrateful wretches."
Gojo tweaked the shrew's ear.
"Aye, maybe I am. So I'll stay awake and cut the throat of any crew member found snoring. How'll that do you?"
Dan sniggered.
"Better cut your Song's throat right now." "Ooh, you listen, Danfloor Raguba. You're the snorer, not me."
"Oh, yes, yes. Dan's a grand old snorer. But I think the champion's got to be me good mate Dip. Yes, yes."
"Ha! Strike me blue, look who's talking. Any beast out on that lake would think it was a foghorn if you kicked off snoring."
"Who, me? Oh, you fibber. Water voles don't snore, tis a fact."
Gojo shook with laughter as he watched the indignant young creatures. The old squirrel cut short the dispute with a wave of his paw.
"Ha! Snore. You think you can snore? Now, Torob and these hogs, they can snore. I'll be surprised if there's a leaf left on any tree within the area by the time they're done snoring." "Huh. You ain't heard snorers until you've slept in the same cabin as my family. I should know. 'Tis me who's had to suffer these many long seasons."
Torob gave Gojo an affectionate pat, nearly knocking him flat.
"Thou sayest the nicest things, ancient one."
Song giggled.
"Give him another pat, Auntie Torob."
Whether through excitement or overtiredness, the occupants of the cabin had difficulty in getting to sleep. Dippler propped himself up on a cushion.
"Come on, Song. Give us a little tune. Mayhap that'll help us to doze off. Your grandpa ain't heard you singing."
Song recalled a ditty of her grandma Elio's that reminded her of the joy she felt at watching McGraw fly.
"I sit alone and wish that I could be a bird up in the sky. I'd join the breezes that do blow, whichever way they chance to go. Far o'er the waves across the sea, I'd drift along quite happily. Or maybe out on field and fen, I'd circle round some forest glen. I envy bee and butterfly. Maybe the birds could tell me why I wipe a teardrop from my eye. I sit alone, for I can't fly."
In actual fact, it was Gojo who was wiping a teardrop from his eye, his mind wandering back over the seasons.
"Elio, my wife, used to sing that. Almost as pretty as you do, Song.
Of course, she was much younger in those days."
Song stroked the old gray head of her grandpa. "She's still young at heart, you'll see." Gojo stretched out, closing his eyes.
"Maybe I will, if we live through what lies ahead, young'un."
Outside, it began to rain, softly at first, increasing as a breeze sprang up over the vast reaches of the hidden lake. One of Silth's ceremonial cloaks, held on the spear points of two soldiers,
provided cover for Mokun against the driving rain. The Marl Fox was in high spirits, far too cheerful to allow a wet morning to ruin his joy. Striding across a high-walled roof at Castle Marl, he peered over at the ground far below. "Set it up here." With the aid of 12 slaves, Wilka and Ulig staggered forward, bent beneath the weight of Queen Sylph's palanquin. Grunting and groaning, they strained upward until it rested precariously atop the wall. Wilka and Ulig stood bareheaded in the rain among the slaves, awaiting King Mokun's pleasure. He flicked a paw dismissively at them. "You two, shove it over." It needed only a slight push, and then there was several seconds' silence, broken by a rending crash. The Marl Fox giggled like a youngster as he stared over the wall top at the smashed palanquin on the ground. "I always hated that thing. Tell some beast to burn what's left of it when the weather clears up." "Right. Follow me. Come on. Come on, all of you." Wilka and Ulig exchanged apprehensive glances before running in the wake of slaves and soldiers after Mokun down the winding slopes of the castle's corridors. The Marl Fox rushed helter-skelter in the lead and arrived at the door of Castle Marl's main chamber, smiling and exhilarated. "What took you so long? Ha-ha, getting too fat, Ulig. And you, Wilka. Inside, all of you. Step smartly now." A big carved oak chair had been set in the center of the floor. Mokun practically skipped over to sit on it. He banged his paws down on the chair arms. "What do you think? Not bad, eh? Of course, it's not a real throne, but it'll do until I have one made. The throne of High King Mokun. Ha ha ha, I like that. If my fool brothers and sisters have survived, they'll meet a fine welcome if they try to return." He waved imperiously at the two water rats who had been holding the cloak aloft with their spears. "You've been with me since I left Redwall Abbey, right?" The two stolid guards nodded silently. Mokun leapt up, energy surging through him, and smiling and winking at the two dullards, he clapped their backs heartily. "Tell me your names. Speak up, don't be afraid."
"Tulum, sire, majesty."
"Durlo, your majesty." The Marl Fox paced a circle around both rats, looking them up and down approvingly. "Good, honest soldiers. Faithful and obedient. Just what a king needs. Durlo, you are now my personal advisor. Tulum, I promote you to be commander of my army." Adopting a look of mock sadness, he nodded at Wilka and Ulig. "Loyalty brings its reward, you see. I always told you, never trust a vixen. And now look what Lontor has brought you to." "Oh, don't look so glum. I found an important job for you both, so cheer up." The two water rats managed to put on uneasy smiles. Mokun winked mischievously at them. "You can hang my beautiful tapestry for me. Let me see. That wall over there should do. Tulum, Durlo, see to it that they hang it good and straight. Use your spear butts to chastise them if they don't. Ulig, I'm sorry, my old friend. I can't afford an untrustworthy captain. So you're back to being a rank-and-file soldier again. Wilka, you've had it too easy for long enough. It's backed into uniform for you, I'm afraid. Right, that's that. I'm off to see what the cooks have prepared for my breakfast. I'm famished enough to eat a meal fit for a king." "Fit for a king. Good, eh? Ha 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 ha." Mokun paused at the door and pointed to the slaves. "You'll find that nothing escapes your new king's notice. Work hard and well, I may free you from slavery and promote you to be soldiers in my army. Tell your friends this. And you soldiers, if I find you to be slow and lazy, then I'll take away your uniforms and make slaves of you. Let your comrades know this. But remember this, all of you. Even think of playing me false, and you'll find out the lake still possesses teeth. Make sure every beast knows that." The door slammed, and the self-proclaimed King Mokun could be heard trotting off down the sloping passage, laughing at the echo of his own voice. "I'm feeling hungry today. Hungry! Ha 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 ha!" The slaves were left in a bewildered group by the door, murmuring quietly to each other. "Never heard nothing like that in all the time I've been here. Aye, he's as mad as his mother was. It must be the sudden power gone to his brain, I think. I'd sooner be dead than serve a Marl Fox as a soldier. Crazier than his sister was, if you ask me. Who's bothered about what we think? No beast asks a slave anything, mate. They tells them." A water rat soldier prodded the speaker roughly with his spear.
Stow the gab there. Silence, you lot. Back down to the pens with you. Quick march. 1, 2, 1, 2.
The hefty hedgehog maid, who had made the final remark, muttered to her companion, a grizzled old shrew, "See what I mean, friend?" Tulum gestured at the rolled tapestry. He felt nervous and unsure at issuing orders to creatures who had formerly been his superiors.
Pick it up.
Without any argument, Wilka and Ulig bent to lift the tapestry. Suddenly, Tulum was seized by a wave of confidence he had never felt before. Inflating his narrow chest, he realized that he really was commander of the army. A slow grin suffused his normally expressionless features.
"Be careful you don't damage it, you clumsy fools."
Durlo joined him, eager to exploit his newfound powers.
"Aye, or you'll feel our spear-handles, you butter-pawed oafs."
As Wilka and Ulig staggered to the wall with the tapestry slung carefully between them, Tulum and Durlo grinned at each other and swaggered boldly behind the subdued pair. They had begun to realize that power was a mighty intoxicating thing to possess. 32. Gray afternoon cast its pall over the lake. Sheeting rain swept back and forth, causing the surface to spatter under a ceaseless bombardment of drops. When the raft had been pulled clear of the shallows, Gojo dropped a piece of trout, donated by the McGraw, into the lake. It drifted beneath the water for a moment. Then two pike struck, dragging it under as they fought for possession of the morsel. Torob watched over the old squirrel warrior's shoulder.
"Methinks 'tis time we sought out the bows, father."
Gojo wiped fishy paws on his jerkin, nodding agreement.
"Aye, daughter, this is where the pike shoals start."
Short bows with thin, sharp arrows were fetched from the cabin. Torob and six other hedgehogs notched shafts to their bowstrings and began firing arrows in a sloping direction at the water. Soon a pike was hit. It thrashed about close to the surface, vicious and hook-jawed, a real lake monster. The arrow had wounded it, causing a blood trail in the water, and with terrifying speed it was attacked by a horde of other pike. The hedgehog shot arrows furiously into the shoal, hitting the big fish indiscriminately, until Gojo gave the order to stop firing. Song had watched the whole thing from a cabin window. She did not like to see any living thing slain needlessly. The squirrel maid questioned her grandpa as he stamped into the cabin, shaking rain from himself.
"Why were you shooting at the fish, grandpa?"
Gojo sat down at the table, wriggling a paw on his damp ear.
"All part of the plan, my young beauty. This lake's swarming with pike. They've tried to attack us before now. You don't realize how big and dangerous some of those fish have become. So the plan is to shoot one. The pike are natural cannibals. They'll go for that'n and eat it. So we shoot a few more, and pretty soon they come far, far and wide to feed on them."
Song shuddered.
"Ugh, how horrible."
Gojo shrugged, pouring himself some hot mint and dandelion tea.
"Aye, 'tis not a pretty sight, but that's the nature of pike. They'll fight or eat in their own so fiercely that they bite each other, causing more blood to flow. Before you know it, nearly all the pike in the lake are gathered there, snapping and ripping each other to bits. While their bloodlust is on them, they won't bother us or our raft."
McGraw watched the rainy skies from the window.
"What a waste of good food. Nary a sign of the magpies out on yon lake yet. Maybe inclement weather's keeping them close to hame on their isle."
Gojo sipped his tea gratefully.
"The weather's on our side, and the wind's driving us toward the island. With luck, we may make land by the morrow's dawn."
Burble picked up a small stringed instrument from the corner where he was sitting and twanged it.
"Can any beast be after playing this thing? Mayhap song will give us a titty, yes, yes."
A huge male hedgehog relieved Burble of the instrument.
"Nay, River Mousie, sound doth carry far o'er waters like these."
Song pulled a face at her friend. "He's right, you know, River Mousie. You'll have to recite us one of your River Mousie poems, nice and quiet now."
Burble's fur actually bristled with indignation.
"Sure, I'll recite nothing while I'm being insulted. If any beast calls me River Mousie once more, I'll fight him. Yes, yes, so I will. I don't call you Tree Walloper, do I?"
Song laughed at her bristly companion.
"Call me what you like, I don't care, River Mousie."
Dippler burst out laughing.
"Ha, ha, ha! River Mousie, that's a good un."
Burble rounded on him with a wicked grin.
"Who asked you, Boat Bottom?"
The cabin became a verbal battleground, as laughing and giggling, they hurled insults at one another.
"Ho, ho, ho, Boat Bottom, that's a great name for you, Dip."
"Who is it now, Danflower Broomtail? Haw, haw, haw."
Gojo joined in.
"Hee, hee, Fluff Ears is a better name for that'un, or Popple Paws. Hee, 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 hee."
"Popple Paws yourself, old baggy barrel belly."
"Ya, ha, ha, ha."
Torob poked her head round the cabin door.
"Be there any within to relieve the watch this day?"
She was greeted with a barrage of impudent merriment.
"Go away, Spiky Bonce. I push off, Needle Nose. Out in the rain with you, Soggy Hog. Go and watch yourself, Squelch Spines."
The burly hogmaid grinned and called to McGraw.
"What about thee, Binnacle Beak?"
Dropping down from the window, McGraw spread his massive wings and glared about him savagely, raising a hooked talon.
"Which was that you call it me, marm? Nary a beast livin' mixed sport of the mighty McGraw."
End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.